welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, DACA, immigration, and the Supreme Court. And Richard, we just recently got a decision from the Supreme Court blocking the Trump administration's effort to overturn the Obama administration's DACA policy, which the Obama administration, of course, did through executive power. And this would have shielded people who were brought into the country illegally as children from deportation. Now the court, in a 5-4 opinion with Chief Justice Roberts joining the Democratic appointees, said that the Trump administration had not adhered to the relevant administrative law requirements to do this, thus prevented the Trump administration from enacting it, or unenacting it, I suppose, as the case may be. So let's actually start prior to this case on a point that was material to the outcome in this case. Richard, the Trump administration proceeded on the conviction that what the Obama administration had done here was illegal, that DACA was beyond the bounds of what could be done through executive discretion. What's your view of that question?
I think it's actually an open and shut question. Everybody who's ever thought seriously about the question, including Barack Obama, believed that his actions were illegal. The way in which this particular thing went is early on he was under tremendous pressure to put DACA into place. I might add that I'm strongly in favor of the DACA proposal that he put into place. I thought, with the exception of maybe the way in which he was trying to influence state law judgments, it was a perfectly sensible compromise. But he said over and over again, I am not a king, I cannot do this. I had a debate with this at one time with one of my colleagues, and I couldn't quite remember where the illegality was admitted, and one of my very smart students took out her computer, and by the time 30 seconds had passed, we found that he had made 11 separate statements to the effect that he could not do it. And then he does it. So it's not only that when you start looking at the thing that you realize it's utterly inconsistent with the scheme, it's also that But when you actually look at it, he's admitted that it's done. The Immigration Act is not a big discretion statute. One of the points that Judge Kavanaugh, I think, made in the dissent was, you look at this thing, it's highly reticulated. And it turns out that the arbitrary and capricious standard, or whatever you're talking about, applies to the president. He just doesn't have any room under this statute to change fundamental categories. So the whole thing is illegal. And what is so striking about the opinions is that the majority opinion seems to think that this is a minor detail.
Okay, so let's, as you suggested there, let's sort of break down the variety of responses we got on the court. So in this opinion, the majority opinion, Chief Justice Roberts said that the Trump administration had run afoul of the Administrative Procedure Act, which sets the parameters for policy changes made through the executive branch, that the administration had not demonstrated a thorough or thoughtful enough engagement with the issues that rescinding the policy would entail. And then in dissent, Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch said, essentially, it doesn't matter. If this was illegal in the first place, the Trump administration doesn't have to go through those niceties. And then less noted was what you mentioned earlier, the separate dissent from Justice Kavanaugh, who said, in essence, you know what, they actually did satisfy those requirements. The administration had released a follow-up analysis that was a little more thoroughgoing. Justice Kavanaugh thought that got them into the clear. So walk us through how this works. Under the present law, what obligations does the executive branch owe when it comes to these kinds of policy shifts through the administrative state? And does the existing standard make sense to you?
Well, the standard that one had before this particular case was decided is that if an action turns out to be illegal, it is impermissible for anybody to rely upon it. And in particular, it's also impermissible for anybody to rely upon it when the actual order which puts it into place says that nobody's entitled to rely upon it, which was the case with respect to the DACA order, because they were trying to preserve their option. So if the thing is illegal, then the only thing that you have to do in order to revoke it is to demonstrate its illegality, which was not in dispute. Because as I mentioned earlier, Obama himself had admitted that he had gone way off the reservation because of the moral imperative of putting the thing into place. If it's legal, then of course you have a very different question. And if you have an executive order that is legal and there is reliance interest on it, somebody might be prepared to make the case that it cannot be removed. Even that position turns out to be a little bit dicey because, for example, if you think about the executive orders that were used in order to deal with the Iran deal, one of the reasons why Trump was able to effectively sabotage and reverse that is it was done not by treaty but by executive order, and what the president does in one form, he can undo in the other. And then the next question is, what's the standard of review, assuming that there is some standard of review? And here what happened is the Chief Justice essentially invoked the State Farm case having to do with the definition of arbitrary and capricious. Now, State Farm is a notoriously controversial decision because what it seems to say in many cases, or did say, is that if it turns out that you want to revoke an order that's already in place, what you have to do is to meet the definition of arbitrary and capricious, which says that you must consider everything that is relevant and you must ignore everything that's not relevant. And that standard is almost impossible to meet in these cases, particularly when you're dealing with some very, very complicated legislation, which has lots of moving parts. And so when they basically prevented the rescission in State Farms, many people, myself included, thought that this was a real abuse of the way in which arbitrary and capricious meant, because the standard definition of that is there's any reason whatsoever that you can put forward which supports a particular situation. And then the literal meaning of arbitrary, it isn't that because you have a reason for it, and it's not capricious because you've already thought about it. But what's happened in modern administrative law is the two words are run together, arbitrary and capricious, but very rapidly, and you don't know from one day to the next whether it's a very high standard of review, as it was in State Farm, or whether it's a much lower standard of review. That's for cases in which the original order was legal. But in this case, the thing was illegal. And so I think Justice Thomas was exactly correct in a very, very strong dissent, I might add, to say, no. You can't basically do this. If somebody is doing it, you can't create a one-way ratchet where you put this thing into place, have massive consequences for the system. Nobody's in a position to be able to challenge it. And then when somebody wants to reverse it, what you do is you give very kind of close scrutiny as to whether or not the reasons turn out to be adequate, or whether you've considered all the permutations and variations, or at least enough of them for this thing to go, and then throw in a reliance interest, which essentially locks you into this particular situation. This is really dangerous because all of these things are going to have to confront the shift between administrations. And we know right now that Republicans and Democrats don't see eye to eye pretty much on anything. And if it turns out that this is the particular rule, you get this situation where one president by executive order can essentially bind the successor unless they can untangle the mess. This means, by the way, not that they can't untangle it. It just means that you have to go back and try it again under these circumstances, which I think is a really very, very bad mistake. What was so disingenuous about the majority opinion is that the illegality point, which is point one, page one, paragraph one, word one of the Thomas dissent, sort of gets introduced into the argument about three-fourths of the way through the opinion as a rather minor point, when in fact the difference between legality and illegality is a bright line rule that has to be clearly taken into a case if the whole system is going to work.
Richard, there's been a strain of criticism about this case that says, yes, it may be annoying that the outcome looked like this, that perhaps the court is being too aggressive on matters of administrative procedure, but that the Trump administration also should have been able to see that coming a mile away and could have easily evaded it with better lawyering. So two quotes on this, the first of which from Dan McLaughlin at National Review. He mentions the criticism in the case that the administration didn't explicitly mention the prospect of Congress addressing the issue. And he writes, quote, "While it would have been better staff work to mention this in the original memo on repeal, a theme we find endlessly in Trump administration actions, it is positively surreal to decide that the court could not even consider the argument." And then the second quote, a little more pungent, from Stephen Vladeck, constitutional law professor at UT Austin. "It's not that Chief Justice Roberts is a closet progressive. He's not. It's that the Trump administration is really bad at administrative law." How much weight do you give to those criticisms?
Well, if the point that I made about illegality is correct, they're not wrong. The situation is, if the action that was put into place is illegal, you do not have to have any substantive justification to get rid of it. And I don't think it's bad lawyering not to engage in surplusage, if in fact you're correct on the initial premise. What I really think about is that this should not have happened. Now, there is an argument on the second issue about bad law. What happened is the order gets challenged after there's a decision in Texas in the DAPA case having to do with parents, and it goes back to the administrative agencies, and the second person who looks at it sees what the first woman had written, and she decides, you know, that's enough. I'm just going to ratify the decision. And what happens is the Roberts Court starts to say, look, under these circumstances, the standard rule is the only thing that you look at to figure out whether or not a statute or a justification is real are the arguments are made at the time that it was introduced. And so I cannot take into account anything that was taken at a subsequent time after the hearing was done. I regard this as a preposterous form of formalism. It turns out all of this information was on the record. All the information was accurate before it got to the United States Supreme Court. And so what they're saying is that we're not going to look at this stuff, because what she should have done second time round was to announce, look, what I'm doing is I'm revoking the first order. I'm going to put it back together again with these additional justifications. Then it will be fine. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever why, if you have all the information available on the record, you choose to ignore some, which tips the balance on the other side. That's an extremely aggressive reading, and it's one of the things that I think Justice Kavanaugh, in his short dissent on arbitrary and capricious point, that out, said he's never seen a case in which stuff which has been properly introduced and passed is going to be regarded as irrelevant because it came subsequent to the time of the order, even though it came long before the final order was put into place or litigated. So I don't think it's bad lawyering at all. I mean, there is this tendency to sort of attack Trump and his lawyers on everything. His public statements often drive me up the wall, and I'm certainly opposed to what he wants to do on the DACA case. But I've looked at a lot of executive orders coming out from underneath the Trump administration, and I would say exactly the opposite. The professional team that Trump has put together to handle these executive orders has been, for the most part, very strong, and the work that they do legally is very, very good. And I think it's just a mistake to assume, because you don't like the way in which the president reminisces when he goes on Twitter or something of that sort, and that what you have to do is to impugn the entire quality of the Trump legal team. I'm going to say it again, as I've said it before. The president is his own worst enemy. The professionals he's put to play underneath him, for the most part, have been very, very excellent. I would refer people, if they want to get some sense as to how the administration actually works on a day-to-day basis, there's an excellent column today, I think it's on Politico, by my friend Casey Mulligan, who worked in the administration, who said that everything that John Bolton said about the haphazard and erratic nature of the way in which things work in private was just an outright falsehood. I mean, it's important to keep that into place, and I don't think Vladek does anybody a real service when they constantly try to make sure that anytime something goes wrong, it's not that there's an unsound legal opinion, it's that there was something wrong with the lawyering of the administration, and this happens over and over again. I don't think that it's a proper way to do it. One could be opposed to Trump on many issues as I am, but I don't think in this particular case, the small errors in records that they supposedly found in this case justifies postponing this order because it was illegal to begin with, and the only thing that you have to say when an order is illegal, we revoke it because of its illegality. You don't have to basically say, oh, by the way, the order is illegal, but it's also sound, and now it's not as sound as you thought it was, and we will explain why it is that this thing ought to be into place. I want to repeat again, my view is that it was a complete breakdown in the political process, that the president and the Congress could not find a way to shepherd the DACA reform through Congress where it could be done correctly and be done legally. I don't know where the greater part of the blame lies on that particular question, but it does not excuse what I regard as a stunningly insincere, I think is the appropriate word, opinion that Justice Roberts wrote for the four liberals, because they did not object the first and most important question of the case, except as a kind of an added extra after they've gone through all of this kind of tedious administrative law, announcing under the standard rules in Abbott Laboratory, a very important 1967 case, that all the exceptions to reviewability ought to be narrowly construed and so forth. That's with respect to legal orders. There is no presumption in favor of illegal orders being allowed to sustain themselves. This case should have been decided in a very short and pointed sort sort of opinions, and they should have remanded it to the president and the Congress to figure out what to do with respect to the DACA status. That should have been done years ago. I'm sorry it has not been done. I mean, I've had a fair number of students who are DACA-based, and I think it would be a national tragedy for them to be expelled. And I think that the breakdown in the political process essentially is a sad commentary on the way in which the United States political system works today. Roberts' opinion is a sad commentary on the way in which the majority of the Supreme Court on some of these administrative law positions start to work as well. This was not a fine day for the Chief Justice. He should not have written that particular opinion. I contrast it with the opinion he wrote in Trump v. Hawaii, where he thought very powerful opinion in defense of executive authority. Justice Sotomayor in that case sort of dissented on the grounds that motive really does matter, and she used alone, fortunately, exactly that argument in this particular case, saying the things that Trump said during the election about Mexicans and Hispanics being the majority of the people under DACA, the whole program should be set aside because of suspect motive. I don't think that that is a defensible line of argument. I think it's very good that everybody else in the case rejected that particular point. But I think on the administrative law cases that he put forward, it was a set of grievous errors by the Chief Justice. This is not an opinion he should be proud of.
All right, so final question. As we discussed a bit last week, conservatives have developed a pretty sour taste in their mouths around Chief Justice Roberts because of cases like this one. That was then compounded last week by Justice Gorsuch writing the opinion in the Bostock case on employer discrimination. And that has led to some real councils of despair amongst people on the right who are beginning to think that it doesn't matter how many justices they get on the court. Things are always going to blow up in their faces. Josh Hawley, the freshman Republican senator from Missouri, said last week, in the wake of the Bostock decision, for example, this is the quote, "This decision and the majority who wrote it represents the end of something. It represents the end of the conservative legal movement or the conservative legal project as we know it." Richard, is the situation that severe?
Well, it's very hard today. I mean, as a jurisprudential person, I tend to take it one opinion at a time. And I wrote a fairly long, very difficult to write piece on defining ideas, explaining why I thought that the Bostock opinion that Justice Gorsuch put together was a deep philosophical muddle that took perfectly simple and straightforward propositions and made them into something which was almost impenetrable by having false analogies to but-for causation in the law of torts. But on the other hand, he's on the right side of this particular opinion, and I don't know how you start to figure out what's going on. I think it's clear to say that what is troublesome to Hawley, and to some extent is encouraging to me, is he thinks that each of the Republican conservative justices actually thinks for himself. And remember, there are no women on this side of the particular line. And that means when you've got independent thoughts, you're most likely to get lockstep opinion. On the liberal side, there are certainly cleavages that you could start to see. For example, on the pipeline case, it was 7-2. And I thought that the opinion of Justice Elena Kagan was completely indefensible in that particular circumstance, a subject on which I've already worked. But you see a little bit of the weak breakdown. But I think on the big cases, like the one that we have here in Bostock and so forth, I think the four liberals are much more likely to be in lockstep than are the five conservatives. And so if you assume that you've got all these kinds of independent thinking one way or another, the odds of one of the five flaking off or breaking off under these things is probably going to be, you know, in the neighborhood of one-third to one-half. So there is no secure conservative position on this court. We know if any issue is going to come up about affirmative action, for example, or about abortion, the Chief Justice is going to side with the liberals in terms of the question of not undoing the way in which the past has been put together. I have torn views on a lot of these questions because some of the opinions that I think are desperately wrong as a conceptual matter have been in place for a very long time. And so the issue of whether or not stare decisis, what the Trump sound illegal reasoning, is a puzzle on which there's never been a uniform opinion anywhere throughout the jurisprudential system, and you're not going to find it here. I get disappointed in some cases because on an individual case basis, I just don't think that some of the opinions that I see are actually defensible. And I think they're almost incomprehensible. I cannot see how anybody could basically vote the way in which Justice Roberts wrote, if the only issue were illegality of a random administrative order or executive order, rather, but once we know that it's DACA, we know that four votes were already settled. Doesn't matter what the administrative law question is, it's the political question that starts to dominate. And, you know, that's a form of result-oriented jurisprudence which has been around for a very, very long time. I have no question that in liberal circles that we've already seen that the DACA opinion will be hailed as a great victory, and as a political matter, it surely is. But if you're trying to separate the political from the legal, which is increasingly hard to do, then it turns out that the DACA opinion is a great, great disappointment. So what we do is we have this tension all the time. Hawley, by the way, is a man whose opinions I often disagree with as well. So this is not a question of basically having a conservative movement like that. There are many different strands to it, of which the most obvious one is the difference between the libertarian side on the one hand and the judicial restraint side on the other. So just to give you one more riff on this, I mean, Justice Scalia, in his Lujan case, set out the standard requirements for standing under an Article III case. I wrote at the time, and I've held since then, that he's just completely incorrect, that standing in equity allows people to bring a derivative actions in order to block actions which are ultra-various, even if they have an interest which is only held in common with everybody else. But the law has gone on the other way. I do not think that a conservative should support the Scalia opinion in that case. And there are other opinions where I think I have a similar kind of view in some of the takings cases as well. So it's not as though there was always uniformity or always soundness on the right, and the battle on the right between judicial restraint on the one hand and sort of the protection of liberties on the other has gone on for a very long time. And as I were to count the votes on the federal circuits and under the Trump appointees and so forth, I think the majority of them would still regard themselves as people of judicial restraint whose politics would be conservative on the sense of pro-market, whereas their judicial sense is to try to avoid these kinds of entanglements one way or another. So this is not going away, and it's just not unique in this particular case, but it is very much a sign of the times. And if you're trying to find a justice who's going to be bulletproof for the next appointment, should it be made by President Trump, the answer is you're not going to find him or her.
You've been listening to The Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.